Well, welcome to our course on Genesis. I don't know if anybody was here for my course on the Old Testament survey. Did you do it? If you did, there's some of the material at the beginning overlaps, so I do apologize for that, but if you haven't done that, it'll be fresh for you. Well, let's pray and then we can. Father, we bow before you with reverence and joy. We are your people, and we hold in our hands the book you've given us, and we have in our hearts the Spirit that inspired the book, and we pray, let the truth flow like a river and change our lives and build us up in our most holy faith. We pray in the name of Jesus. Well, welcome to our course on Genesis. You have your notes in front of you, and you look on page one, gives you an idea of how I'm going to divide the course up. The first session tonight, which session one and two, I'm going to try and cover the first 11 chapters of Genesis. That's very ambitious. There's a lot in that. But when you study the book of Genesis, Genesis is a it's really two different kinds of books in one. The first 11 chapters trace thousands or hundreds of years of history from the creation through the flood and to the person Abraham. But when Abraham comes on the scene, the whole pace of the book changes. Suddenly, it's not now about the creation of continents and species and worldwide floods. Now it's about a man and his barren wife and their trials. And it tells you about his cousin Lot. So in the first 11 chapters, you have this huge dimension of history. And then in the second half of the book, from chapter 12 to the end of the book, chapter 50, you've got the story of a family. When we get to that, you'll quickly realize this story is really, it's almost so personal that you can't see the backcloth of history. Just a man and his family, you can't place it in a historical context. It doesn't name the Pharaoh. It doesn't say in the time of Pharaoh Thutmose the First or Tutankhamun. It doesn't mention any Pharaoh by name or any king. It mentions a Pharaoh, but it doesn't say who it is. There's no dates. It mentions King Chedorlaomer and title King of Nations, if you know chapter 14. But history doesn't tell us exactly when they lived. We know roughly. So it's difficult to place it, but it's just a short story of this man's life and the generations that followed him. Now, I want to get to Abraham because when we look at Genesis, we could either spend all of the sessions on the first 11 chapters, but I want to spend four sessions out of the eight. I've divided it here into eight sessions. And the middle four I want to spend on Abraham. Abraham is the father of the faith. And in many ways, he is one of the most important Bible figures. Certainly, he's very prominent in the book of Romans, the book of Hebrews, and he is the father of all the faithful. So what we read about Abraham is very important. Then we will go on to the last sessions will be on Jacob and Esau. But I'm not going to rush, and if we don't get through the first 11 chapters tonight, we'll spill over into the next session. If we don't complete it, and you want me to complete it, you want an extra session, I'm happy to give you an extra session. We can arrange a time and we can do some more study together. So don't worry, I'm available. We can finish the course one way or the other. Either I rush it at the end, or we can do an extra session. So tonight we're looking at Genesis chapters 1 to 11, and as I've said, that's a very ambitious project. And if you turn to the page, one of the notes, and the first place I want to start here looking at Genesis chapter 1, when you look at the stories of the creation, in chapter 1 and 2, you have two different accounts. When I say two different, I don't mean different except in the perspective. The first account in chapter 1, God gives us a platform in outer space. When you read chapter 1, you have to imagine that you are standing with God in outer space. Nothing is created, and then God begins to create. And in chapter 1, you can see the whole universe coming into being. That's in chapter 1, the creation story. In chapter 2, you're not in outer space anymore. You're standing on the ground and God's making a garden. He's planting a garden. Before he plants the garden, he makes a man. And we find his name, and he makes the animals and so on, everything. But you see, the thing is, it's the perspective. First from outer space, then chapter 2, down on the earth, watching God handle the dust and make a man. Now, of course, the book of Genesis is one of the most attacked books by Satan, and therefore we're not surprised that the whole theory of evolution attacks the book of Genesis, and even liberal scholars will attack the book of Genesis. I'm not going to talk about liberal scholars. And I'm not going to go into the theory of evolution as a theory. You know about it already. But the reason this book is under attack is because if God did not begin everything, well, of course, you know, the whole history of the world becomes different. Where did God start? If man came from the apes, where did soul begin? Where did you get your soul from? Do you even have a soul? The evolutionist believes in the beginning is matter, physical matter, no soul. So all of those things come from, you know, nowhere. They're just matter. In the end, he believes there will be just matter. The two books that are most attacked in the Bible are Genesis and Revelation. The beginning and the ending. And, of course, these tell us of the origins of our world. They tell us why the world is as we see it. They explain the world to us. They give us the foundations of life as we see it. And really, the world can only be understood if we understand our origins as they are described in the book of Genesis. And we only understand the human race if we understand our destiny, which is described in the book of Revelation. You will find very close similarities between the first three chapters of the Bible and the last three chapters of the Bible. Because as God began in one place, his goal has never changed. And in the end, you will see something very similar. So you find a tree of life at the end of the book. You find a river. And you find all these wonderful things, these themes, taken up again as God fulfills his plan in human history. Now, so this book has been under attack by from all kinds of angles. And there have even been some Christians who have said, well, maybe the truth is a mixture of evolution, and God maybe made evolution happen. Some have even said that the seven chapters of, the 7 days of creation are 7 phases of evolution. And if you look in chapter, if you look in my notes, why can Genesis 1 and 2 not be harmonized with evolution? Here's two reasons. A, because the sun was created on the fourth day, And the plants were created on the third day. So if they were phases of evolution, well, that means that plants evolved before the sun, which is, of course, nonsense. The second reason is because evolution would deny the immortal soul of man, the gulf, the gap between the apes and man. There's a huge gap. But when did the soul of man come in? There's no explanation in evolution of such a thing. Is Genesis scientific? Is it a scientific book? Yes, it is, in that it explains the scientific fact of genes. That means when you look into the fact of the genetic code, if you look at, when you look at, say, the genetic makeup of an orange, it produces another seed of its kind, and that is a biological fact, that is a scientific fact. And we know that in the realm of science, these rules are fast and solid. The species, whether they be plant or animal, cannot pass beyond their genetic limit. And the Bible says that very plainly in chapter 1, that they reproduced after their kind. That's a scientific statement. In other words, whatever you see, whatever barriers you see in the genetic makeup of plants and animals, they are absolutely unbreakable barriers. You cannot cross the barrier of genetic makeup. Darwin, Charles Darwin, was a pigeon breeder. One of his hobbies was to breed pigeons, and like doves. And he would breed them, and he could see that there would be changes in the doves. And the like dogs and pigeons and various animals, you can breed them and you can make them change, have bigger tails, smaller tails, and different stuff by interbreeding them. But he found, like all these experiments, that you reach a limit and you cannot cross that limit. There is an unseen, invisible wall between the species. And if you look into all the fossil record that we have, and we have millions of fossils by now, they all fall into specific genetic species. In other words, an oak tree is the same today as it was even in the fossil record. Now, yes, it explains the scientific fact of genes. B, yes, it harmonizes with scientific discoveries, and we'll talk about more about that in a moment. C, yes, there are more creationists among scientists than in any other discipline. If you ask scientists, do you believe in creation? There are huge numbers of scientists who say yes, they believe, because they believe that what they know about science agrees with creation. D, however, Genesis is not written as a scientific treatise. It's not written like a scientific textbook. It's not given to us, even though it does not contradict science, it is not given as a scientific textbook. And although we live in an age in which science has done wonderful things for us, one thing is clear to us all if we read the Bible, that is that science cannot cure humanity. It can help us live longer, but it does not promise us longer life. The Bible tells us that long life is a fruit of obedience to God. It tells children, if you obey your parents, you can live long on the earth. So I hope you're still obeying mom and dad. If you want to be healthy. But you see, these are spiritual laws which the Bible is giving us. And the Bible teaches us that spiritual laws are behind and above even the physical laws that we see around us. That is why when Jesus came, he did not come with the secrets of medical science. The secrets of medical science help humanity, but they don't save humanity. And Jesus knows that we all know in this room, I hope, that no matter how much we know about medical science, it does not cure the soul. And it doesn't stop doctors having problems with drink, depression, and so on, and addictions, and immorality. My next question is, does science prove the God of the Bible? And the answer to that is no, it doesn't. It proves the existence of a supreme being. Is this too loud? Is it okay? A bit loud. It's too loud, you can indicate. If I'm hurting your eardrums, that's not my intention. Is it too loud for you? You okay? You like it this level? Okay? Okay, does science prove the God of the Bible? No, it proves the existence of a supreme being. It does not give his name. Now, in some way that is not completely true. The Bible, the science actually does indicate the truth of death and resurrection. Because the truth of a seed dying and rising indicates death and resurrection, which indicates the Christian gospel. The butterfly emerging from a chrysalis is the Christian gospel. If we will die to sin, we will stop being ugly caterpillars and we will become wonderful butterflies. But the truth is that if we die to sin, we find resurrection power and we become this wonderful new creation. But that truth is written in science. We can read it in nature. But still, we have to admit that the knowledge of Jesus Christ does not come through nature. It comes through the Son of God himself who came into this world. And the Bible is the preparation for the coming of the Son of God. And the Son of God brings the revelation of the heart of God. Now we can move to section B. What proofs are there to confirm the creation? And here I've got, first of all, missing links. And, I'm going through these fairly quickly because this is just scientific background. It may interest some more than others. If you really don't like this scientific bit, you can switch off and have a little sleep now while I'm going through this. But I just go through these quickly because although they are not vital, it is wonderful to realize that as Christians, we must not be afraid of science. Science will always be debated, but you must not be afraid of science. And you must realize that the proof is actually on the side of creation. We are not defending our position against science. We are using science to defend the truth of the Bible. What I mean by this is that, you could think, well, is science contradicting the Bible? We're saying the Bible is right and science is wrong. No, we're saying the science proves the Bible to be true. And how can I demonstrate this? First of all, the missing links. There is no connection between matter without life and life. The scientists have never been able to find that life has appeared spontaneously. They have attempted to produce conditions in the laboratory, but nowhere has it ever been observed, naturally occurring, and nowhere has a scientist ever succeeded in making life from non-life. Now this is a very serious missing link, obviously. The scientists have now accepted this to the point where they say that the latest scientific position is science did not arise on Earth. The scientists believe it came on an asteroid or a meteorite from outer space and landed on the Earth. But of course, that then begs the question, where did life arrive in the universe to get on the meteorite, to travel so many millions of miles in very difficult conditions of cold and high temperatures in outer space, to arrive safely on planet Earth after burning up in the atmosphere, and then when it gets to planet Earth, it is in such good condition that it can thrive and produce living material. But the scientists believe this. There are people seriously suggesting that life came to this world on a meteorite. Now, to me, that is an incredible faith to believe that. It defies reason. It's not rational. But you see, the scientists who don't believe because they don't take God into account, they are looking for some explanation, and it's difficult to find one. So the first missing link is between non-life and life. The second missing link is between apes to men. And here I've got a list of some of the most interesting ape men discoveries. And if you were interested in this, there's a very good book which I've discovered, or my wife discovered today, is on the it's on a website. This book is obtainable free on a website. It's an excellent book, and if you want the website, you can come and see my notes afterwards. I'm going to quote from this book now, so you'll maybe get some interest after you hear the quotes. So, what are the main missing links? The main claims is that there are about 6 or 7 main ape men discoveries. What are they? Well, the first one is Neanderthal man. Neanderthal man has been discovered in different parts of the world. And in this book that I've just quoted, In the Minds of Men, if you want to find out about it, come and find it here. He looks at one of the scientists who examined Neanderthal man, which was found in Germany, in Poland, in France, in different countries. And one scientist, his name is Virchow, he examined them and he found that the bones of Neanderthal man are actually deformed human bones. He said, this is a man with extreme arthritis. And of course, when you say that, other scientists said, but there are so many. How could so many have arthritis? And then he looked at others and he said it's gross pathological deformity. They found other Neanderthals with large skulls, larger than modern man's skulls. They made museum reconstructions of them. But modern scientists have revisited the bones and said they are suffering from severe arthritis and probably something called rickets. Have you heard of rickets? Rickets occurs in children who are human beings. Their legs become bent, curved, their bones become curved, a lack of vitamin D, and they believe that probably this human group were probably formed in a period when the atmosphere was darkened by something and there was an extreme lack of sunlight. And since then they have found Neanderthal skeletons in Poland with a suit of chain armor, an armor suit. Now this places Neanderthal man as modern man, so that now they call him Homo sapiens Neanderthalis. And they say, the evolutionists say, yes, that's a human skeleton, but it's 35,000 years old, possibly up to 70,000 years old. But then they found a living Neanderthal, a living human being, who by X-ray they have found has all the same characteristics of Neanderthal man. So Neanderthal man is not even an ancient form of man. He is just modern man, but very sick. And you can find these details in this book, In the Minds of Man. It's not a crackpot book. It's a very good scientific book. I'll go through these quickly, otherwise I'll be too long. But the second one, I've got here about eight altogether. I'll just go through them very quickly. The second one is The Lady from Guadeloupe. You all know where Guadeloupe is, don't you? You'll be tested on this at the end of this. Where's Guadeloupe? My wife doesn't know. Does anybody know where Guadeloupe is? I've forgotten. I think it's in the Caribbean, I'm not sure. Anyway, The Lady from Guadeloupe is an island. I think it was governed by the French. But they found a human skeleton in rocks which the scientists say is 28 million years old. And, of course, the scientists know that the human race is not 28 million years old. Nobody even claims that. So how did that human being get down to that rock? This is now beginning to trouble the scientists. But they say that she must have fallen down in an earthquake when the crack opened up and she fell down. But this particular example is so part of the rock. She's embedded in the rock, which tells us that the rock, which is 28 million years old, is probably only about 10,000 years old. We'll come back to that. The Lady of Guadeloupe. The Calaveras skull, this is in Mexico, was found 130 feet below the ground and is so human, the scientists said it must have fallen down there or been taken down there by water. An underground stream must have washed that human skull down there. But what they don't tell you is when they excavated that site, they didn't just find a human skull. They found modern tools. When I say modern, I mean, the last few thousand, they found human tools. Bowls. Cooking pots. There with the skull. And fourth one is Cro-Magnon man. This is caveman. They found caves in France with Cro-Magnon man and all kinds of things, but they say he was some primitive caveman. But they have found, as they've examined the findings, they found that the skeletons of Cro-Magnon man are perfectly human, modern man, but with artistic skills and detailed astronomical knowledge. Totally modern man. I have to include the next one. The next one is Java Man, because he's not quite Singapore Man, but it's not so far. Java Man is fairly close. Java Man was discovered by a man named Dubois. He was from Holland, of course, Java. The Dutch had a lot to do with Java. Anyway, Dubois wanted by all means to find a missing link. So he got there, and he got his workers to start digging out some hills there in Java. He wasn't there when they found these things, but he found a tooth in 1891, September. It's important. A month later, they found a skull cap 15 meters away. August 1892, that's a year later, they found a thigh bone, a femur, and later on, they found a tooth in the same year, about a month later. Dubois believed they were from the same person. Even though separated by mounds of earth, tons of earth, distance in time, but they said they must belong to the same man. And textbooks still say today that Java Man is 500,000 years old. But it's based on such flimsy evidence. Then my favorite is number six, Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man was discovered in England. I'm an Englishman. I'm very proud of this. He was found in Kent, just south of London. He was found there around 1908, so about 100 years ago. And they found a skull, which was definitely human, attached to a jaw, which was definitely ape. So they said, look, we found the missing link. It was an Englishman. And They gave it to various scientists. One dentist had a look at it and said, "It's very strange," he said. "I don't understand it, but this, there are file marks on the teeth of a file." But nobody listened to him. One of the scientists who wrote about it was a man who was knighted by the king in 1921, Sir Edward Keith. And it was placed in the British Museum. People got doctorate theses based on the study of this exhibit. Then in 1953, research showed that this was a recent skull which had been stained artificially to look old. And it was the jawbone of a modern ape which had been filed to change it to look different. It was a hoax. It was a trick. It had been planted deliberately to trick the scientists. And they believed it. And for 50 years, doctorates were granted on the basis of this. It's one of the most interesting ones because it shows us that all of these have a common factor in them, that there is such an eagerness and a willingness to find the missing links. We laugh, but these are serious because people in the world believe this. Rhodesian man, they found a skull fully human, Rhodesian. The last one I'll point out here is Nebraskan man. There's nobody here from Nebraska. But have I got a picture of Nebraskan man? Here's a picture of Nebraskan man, if I can find it. That's Cro-Magnon man with his drawings. If you want to look at these afterwards, those are drawings in a cave, very artistic, and they also have astronomical. That's Dubois, the man who found the bones of Java Man, very popular with Singaporeans, I guess. And this is the picture of Nebraska Man. It's here somewhere on the last page. That is Nebraska Man. It's a very small picture. You can pass it round because I'm finished with it now. Can you see Nebraska Man? That picture, you can pass it round. That picture was based upon a single tooth that was found in 1921. And that picture appeared on the front page of an American newspaper. They even produce museum exhibits on such evidence. But the fact is, this single molar tooth was not fully human, but they believed it was human, so they built this picture from it. Then in 1928, 6 years after this was found, someone else said, "No, this is actually matches another discovery. It's from an extinct pig." They matched it with a pig. And then in 1972, a herd of these extinct pigs was found in Paraguay. So not only was it not extinct, not from a pig, it wasn't from a human being, it was from a pig, and the pigs are not extinct, they are alive today. All of these discoveries are incredibly disturbing because there is no links between apes and men. There is a huge gap. There is no explanation. And still, the museums continue to show this. Now, we now move to the next question, which is the age of the Earth. We've covered missing links. We've covered the fact of species I mentioned already. The third point here is the age of the Earth. And on the age of the Earth, I've got lots of points here, and they're again in one of these. This one here, this is the a chapter from this book again, same book. There are lots of books, but this is a very good one. And wonderfully, it's now on the website. The earliest settlement of recorded history, if you talk to historians and so on, archaeologists, the earliest date of recorded history is 3000 BC. writing began around that period. Settlements were incredibly small. The population of the earth was very small. If you extrapolate back from our present day population of about 6 billion, I don't know exactly whether it's 6 or 7, excuse me, makes a big difference to the billion. But there we are, I don't know how big it is, it's a huge number. But if you go back just to one couple, one family, you will find that tracing back from that basis, the history of mankind does not have to be more than about 5, 6, or 7,000 years old. That's till Noah's flood. If you imagine a history of the world of 1 million years, the world would be overrun with millions of ants. Because the numbers, after a million years, they grow so huge. The history of the world cannot be that old. It's very young. The earth is very young. They did experiments, you can read about them in this book, on the age of the Nile Delta. They measured the depth of sediment. They found a statue buried that they know is 3,200 years old. And they reckon that this gives 3.5 inches per year. 3,200 years, that depth. 3.5 inches per year, that's 3.5 inches. But for Lyell's, this is for evolution and the age of the earth to be millions of years, it would have to be 1/1000 of an inch per 100 years. Now, if you are a housewife and you clean the house, or your maid or your mate cleans the house, you know that dust collects at more than 1/1000 of an inch per 100 years. Are you following me? Am I going? I hope you. How fast does dust collect? 1/1000 of an inch for 100 years is ridiculous. There's other examples here, I'll just quote one more. There's so many here about the age of the earth. You can read the book if you're interested in this. Here's an interesting one, you can pass this one around as well. There is a picture of an egg. You know what an egg timer is? You know what an egg timer is? It's that little thing you turn upside down and sand goes from the top to the bottom. There's an egg timer in nature. It's called the Dead Sea. Why is the Dead Sea an egg timer? Because we know how much salt is in the Dead Sea. We can measure it. It tells me here in the book that we've known about it for many years. It's all the figures here. We know how fast salt is going into the Dead Sea, because we can measure the Jordan River. So then we know how old that system is. And it tells you the age here. I think it comes out about 10,000 years. There's so many proofs that the age of the earth is probably in the region of 8 to 12,000 years old. You can pass that one around as well. These are interesting to look at. You can look at them in the break, and if you're interested, here's another interesting thing. Dinosaurs. Dinosaurs, of course, were extinct millions of years ago. There's a dinosaur called the plesiosaur, which was caught in a Japanese trawler about 30 years ago. There's a photograph of it. The Japanese government commemorated that by the production of a stamp. And there was a stamp. Japanese stamp. There's nobody here from Japan, but a Japanese stamp bore the picture of that dinosaur that was caught. That very picture was on the stamp. You can pass that one around too. So the dinosaurs are not necessarily, you know, here's proof that they are alive today in the oceans. Extinct? Yes. Most of them. How? Did they live millions of years ago? No. Because there's another proof. There's another explanation, which is the flood. Now, these, we could go on, we could spend the whole course looking at these things, but these are just to reassure you that Genesis is literally true. When I say literally true, I'm not saying that we have to believe every single dot and comma is a scientific word. Some of it is symbolical. There are symbolical moments. For example, we have to ask ourselves, what is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Was it a tree with a knowledge, with a fruit? It's a symbol, I guess. We don't fully understand what it was. We'll examine it in a moment. But there's an example. There are some things that may be pointing to a spiritual symbol, but the book of Genesis is historical fact. It's founded in history, and it is an account of the origins of the human race. These things are important to establish so that people realize we are not here in conflict with science. This is a book of the actual origins of the human race. And we are entitled to believe scientifically that the human race is of very recent origin, and the world was created by God in an act of God about 8,000 years ago. This has great implications for the world we live in, because one thing is, you know, even the world we live in, look, we are ruining it. It is probably much more fragile than we ever thought. If it was millions of years old, we would imagine, well, it could keep rolling on. But actually, if it's very recent, it means that comparative to its age, 1,000 years, 100 years is a long period of time. If the world was 4.5 billion years old, then 100 years is nothing. But if it's only 8,000 years old, then 100 years is a very significant time. And to do what we are doing to the planet completely changes the science of our planet. We are ruining the planet, but of course, the answer does not lie in green politics. It lies in faith in God and believing in Jesus Christ. We need to be saved from a disease that is greater than a planet problem. We need to be saved from sin. All right, now that's the origin of chapters 1 and 2. We believe that what we have here, these two chapters, is an account of how God created the human race. Now we look at the spiritual side of these chapters. We're going to look now at the spiritual implications of these chapters. And in them, we're going to leave aside number C, but if you want to explore this a bit more, the point C is the link between Darwinism, liberal theology, and the philosophical disasters of evolution. That book I've given you will give you links between evolution and some of the most terrible crimes of the 20th century, and of course now the 21st century. But I remember hearing an interview with a director of an abortion clinic. In England, there are government abortion clinics. And they were interviewing this man, and he said, he was asked, is there a difference between aborting a baby at 1 month or 8 months? He said, scientifically, no. The baby is just matter, chemicals. Aborting a baby between 1 month or 8 months, no difference. Then they said, what about aborting a baby at 9 months? Scientifically, no. What about aborting a baby 1 month old? This was an interview on the radio. Sorry, we can't have questions. We can have questions later, but we're taping this, so, okay? This is what he said. He said, no difference. And then the interviewer said to him, what if there is a God? Could you still continue what you are doing if there is a God? And the man said, of course not. There's a God. All I am doing becomes wrong. But you see, if a baby is just matter, just who cares? Philosophically, and if you look at some of the crimes of the Nazis in the Second World War, children that were deformed, whatever age they were executed, because they were a burden to the state. But you can find things like that in the book. Now, I'm not saying that all evolutionists would be Nazis. That would be completely to misrepresent evolution. But what I'm saying is that there are philosophical consequences of embracing evolution. It reduces the value of a human soul. And a baby is just so much matter. Now we turn to this spiritual side, and here we are in Genesis chapter 1, and we now open our Bibles. At last, you say, we open our Bibles. We've covered the background to the Bible, if you like. We've looked at some of the trouble with creationism and looking at it is, I hope creation, that the truths of creation can open the minds of people who don't believe to consider the Bible as true. These are good things to know and to share with people who don't believe in God. But you must remember that for centuries people believed in creation, like Pontius Pilate probably believed in creation. Caiaphas definitely believed in creation. But it did not make them better men. If you turn to Genesis chapter 1, we have the account of creation, and here we have the story of God creating the world in 6 days. And we've got this first verse, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. These beautiful words, of course, describe the very origins of God's creative act when and this is something we find hard to relate to, that God could create by the power of his word. He just spoke and a world came into being. But that's what we have here. God created from nothing the heavens and the earth. So the origin of all things is God. God is at the origin of everything. It then tells in verse 2 that the earth was without form and void. And the words there in the Hebrew, without form and void, are a wilderness and a ruin. The earth became a wilderness and a ruin. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And although we don't know how this happened, what we do know is that by chapter 3, Satan was a fallen angel. The Bible does not tell us the order of events between God creating angels, creating the earth, the fall of Lucifer, and the creation of man. We only know that Satan fell before the account of chapter 3 when he tempted man, obviously. We don't know what happened in between. Now, people talk about something called the gap theory. They say that in chapter 1 verse 1, God created, then in chapter 1 verse 2, the world, the earth, the universe was a fallen universe. It may be so. We don't have much evidence for it. Possible. But it does not mean that in that gap, plant life or something evolved. Because plant life and animal life on earth was created after verse 2. So if there was a gap, it is possible that between that first verse and the second verse, somewhere in there is the fall of Satan, the fall of this Lucifer, and something that happened in the whole spiritual dimension of the created universe that was beginning to be created. But what you then have in chapter 1 is the account of God separating light from darkness, water from land. You notice in the third day, the water rose out of the sea. It's very wonderful to notice this, that on the third day is resurrection, and on the third day the earth rises out of the sea. On the third day seed life is created, which holds death and resurrection. And on the sixth day, which is man's day, of course, man was created. Man was created on the same day as the animals. Sixth day. And you'll notice that the number 666 is the number of a beast, an animal, and of a man. 666, of course, indicates a man, a beast, a man-beast, the spirit of an animal, which is what you have in Revelation chapter 13, the Antichrist, the spirit of the beast, claiming that he is God, which is the explanation of the number 666, the sixth day, and this Trinity, which forms the beast man, the man with the spirit of a wild beast. Of course, it's a demonic spirit. But here you have the account of creation. And we could look at different things that you can see here, but let's go down to verse 26 and the creation of man, because this is really the most important verse for us in this chapter. Verse 26, this is God speaking. Then God said, "Let us make man